good morning. I'll let you know in advance. I need to run out at the end. I'll not be able to stick around, unfortunately. But we can always continue the conversation by email. Welcome to week two of Game of Thrones, the Persian Empire edition. I will once again reprise my preface that I gave last week. To be clear, this is not an endorsement of Game of Thrones. I have not watched it, will not watch it, and they doubt endorsing my series either. So, yeah, we're even. Last week, we started out with the story of a king who may or may not have been Persian. The odd story of Darius the Mede, this bridge between the Babylonians and the Persians as presented in Tanakh. The story was one of conspiracy specifically by the members of the court of Darius against Daniel, the pursuit of power by them, a weak king, a manipulative court, and hungry lions to boot. That was the story last week. This week we talk about Cyrus the Great. And again, what we're going to see here are lessons in the way the nations around us function. We're also going to see a lesson here in terms of divine control of kings. The idea that's found throughout Tanakh that those who rule do not rule necessarily because of or cannot take the credit themselves for their power and for what they do. But rather, it's the it's all coming from God, and you'll see what I mean when we get into the story. So, just a quick show of hands: how many people have heard of King Cyrus? Okay, so we have familiarity with Cyrus. What's he known for? Ending the Babylonian exile. Sorry, pro-Semitic, maybe. Building the temple, sort of, yeah. Expanding the Persian Empire greatly. He is the one who conquers Babylon, correct? Linda, you were going to say? Okay. So, interesting headline from a few years ago. I brought you in source number one from the Israel National News website. I tend to think this is probably fake news. I tend to think that this was not real. Nonetheless, it was very interesting. Iran is planning on submerging the tomb of King Cyrus, Koresh, as he's called in Tanakh, the Persian king known for authorizing the Jewish exiles to return to Jerusalem to rebuild the Holy Temple. So when you read that opening line, you think, oh, great, they hate the Jews, they hate the fact that Jews came back to the land, and therefore they want to get rid of his tomb. But that's not the way the story plays out. The Iranian Ayatollahs are planning on destroying the tomb as part of a general campaign to sever the Persian people from their non-Islamic heritage. Right? Because Cyrus is, of course, well before there is such a thing as Islam. But not only that, Islam is willing to accept religious leaders from before they started and call them Islamic anyway. In other words, they believe that the founder of Christianity is also, in some sense, a Muslim. But here, as it continues, Cyrus was thought to be a Zoroastrian and was one of the first rulers to enforce a policy of religious tolerance on his huge kingdom. So that's what they're upset about, and therefore they want to get rid of his tomb. And journalist Ron Porat quoted a young Iranian who said that the measures being taken by the Islamic Republic's regime include the destruction of archaeological sites significant to this heritage. So it's a desire to get rid of him because he wasn't a Muslim leader. But that's not the way he's usually mentioned in our day, right? We usually think of Cyrus today in another context. And he comes up in the headlines in another context. Which current leader of a country is often compared to Cyrus in Israeli headlines these days? No. Not Netanyahu. Netanyahu is Jewish.
An Arab country?
No. Oh, come on. He who shall not be named. Trump is, generally speaking, appearing in the headlines. I'm not kidding. The headlines have recently started to compare him to Cyrus because of his recognition of Jerusalem, his willingness to move the embassy, looking at him as a modern-day analog to Cyrus, which, you know, I think the analogy is mistaken, but what it means is that we need to learn more about this fellow Cyrus and what happened with him. So to set the table for this, as we talked about last time, the first temple is destroyed in the year 586 before the Common Era, according to the count of general historians. There is a traditional Jewish count that's different from this, but that's the number I'm going to work with for this morning. The year 586 before the Common Era. That is after many of the Jews have already been exiled. There were waves of exiles by Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. It culminates in the destruction of the temple in 586. Some Jews do remain in Israel. Most are now in exile. In the year 539, before the Common Era, Cyrus II, also known as Cyrus the Great, defeats the last Babylonian king. Right, the last Babylonian king mentioned in Tanakh is Belshazzar. There's another historical tradition of a fellow named Nabonidus. But the Persians, perhaps with the Medes, defeat the Babylonians in the year 539 before the Common Era. Our story picks up right after that conquest, as Cyrus empowers the Jews to return to their land and to build the Beit HaMikdash, to build the temple. And the big question that we're going to contemplate today as we read this story is, what motivates Cyrus? Why does Cyrus do this? Now, I can ask you the question right now, but we're going to actually see some texts that support different points of view. So maybe we'll see a little text first before we start the conversation. Take a look at source number 2. This is from the book of Ezra. It's the beginning of the book of Ezra. Similar passage is at the end of Divrei Hayamim, the book of Chronicles. In the first year of King Cyrus of Persia, when the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah was fulfilled, the Lord roused the spirit of King Cyrus of Persia to issue a proclamation throughout his realm by word of mouth and in writing as follows. Thus said King Cyrus of Persia, the Lord God of heaven has given me all the kingdoms of the earth and has charged me with building him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Any one of you, of all his people, may his God be with him. And let him go up to Jerusalem that is in Judah and build the house of the Lord God of Israel, the God that is in Jerusalem. And all who stay behind, wherever he may be living, let the people of his place assist him with silver, gold, goods, and livestock besides the freewill offering to the house of God that is in Jerusalem. Well, that's nice. Right? We understood what it said. The first year does not mean the first year of his reign, because he hadn't yet conquered Babylon in the first year of his reign. It means the first year of his greater reign after his conquests, including the conquest of Babylon. Right after that, this is what he declares.
So what year are we
about? So we are roughly the year 538 before the Common Era, according to the standard historical count. So it would appear. The completion of the word. The word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah was fulfilled. What does that mean? Anybody know? He had loads of prophecies. Sorry? Shivat Zion, but that's not what it says, right? It says the Shivat Zion means the return of Zion, but what it says is, when the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah was fulfilled, then the Lord roused the Spirit. It's not that he is awakened and that fulfills it. Jeremiah made a prediction, which we are going to come back to, in which he said the Jews would be in exile for 70 years. This is the completion of the 70 years. Not 70 years from the destruction of the temple, but 70 years from the beginning of the exiles that preceded the destruction of the temple. So this is the completion of the 70 years, and it says that Cyrus decides he is going to free the Jews. He issues the decree by word of mouth and in writing. What's the value of saying "and in writing"?
He makes it permanent.
Right, makes it permanent, can't be revoked. Remember the story from the book of Esther, we'll have to come back to that next week, I hope. But the story about Ahasuerus and royal decrees, what's the policy in Persia? You cannot rescind the decree. Once the decree is recorded, you're stuck with it. That doesn't actually always hold true in the Persian Empire, but it does seem to be their preference. So he says, I'm doing this as a verbal declaration. It is also in writing. Very interesting. And he says, the Lord God of heaven has given me all the kingdoms of the earth. That's a little bit of an exaggeration, but we'll give it to him. That's fine. The God of the heavens, though, he says, right? The Lord God of heaven. What does that mean? Sorry? It sounds monotheistic, doesn't it? And which God does he mean? Is he talking as Ahura Mazda? Is he talking about a God of his? They have many gods, don't they? They have two. Zoroastrians have the God of light and the God of darkness. But this sounds like it is indeed one of ours, right? The God of the heavens sounds like he means our God. Is it possible that King Cyrus of Persia is swearing fealty to the God of the Jews? That's a big pill to swallow, right? Notice, by the way, God of the heavens, right? Elokei Shamayim. We usually call God, God of the heavens and the earth. So if you take a look at source number 3, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, writing in the 12th century, says, maybe it was the 11th, he says, he did not say God of the earth, for he, God, had already given it to humanity. Right? God gave us the earth. In fact, Cyrus is king over much of it. So as he said, God has given me all of the dominions of the earth. So all right, God is God in the heavens, and I'm the God here on earth. Fine. This sounds like a very religious declaration, right? This sounds like he is declaring that he believes in the God of the Jews. That's the way I would take this, reading this in a very straightforward way. Notice, by the way, that he identifies the city as Jerusalem, which is in Judea, not necessarily because there are other Jerusalems, but because his scribes may not be familiar with Jerusalem that is in Judea. And who is it who he says should finance this trip? The Jews of the diaspora? Is that true?
No.
The ones that are left behind that don't go.
Ones of his place, so in Jerusalem. Nope, not Jerusalem, for sure not Jerusalem. Sorry, Bernie, you were going to say?
I was going to make the same statement.
So, it's interesting. The translation that I brought you, the JPS translation, takes one perspective, but there are actually multiple perspectives possible on the Hebrew text. The Hebrew text offers a challenging read on this line, and it may be read the way they do, which sounds like it means the Jews who don't go to the land, right? All who stay behind, wherever he may be living, let the people of his place assist him with silver, gold, whatever. It may be the Jews. However, it is a legitimate read, and indeed many commentators do read it, that he's talking about the non-Jews of Persia financing the Jewish return to their land. Why would Joe Persian, right, finance the Jewish return to our land? What's that about? Wanting to get rid of us, right? They'll pay you to get us out. That's one possibility. So we have to discuss this. We have to figure out what in the world is going on here. There's another version of this decree. There's another version of what Cyrus decreed later on in the book. Take a look at source number 4, please. This is the second version of it. In the first year of King Cyrus, issued an order concerning the house of God in Jerusalem. Let the house be rebuilt, a place for offering sacrifices with a base built up high. Let it be 60 cubits high and 60 cubits wide. That's a lot of cubits, by the way. A cubit is generally assumed to be, in feet, is assumed to be about 1.75 feet, 21.6 inches. If someone wants to do the translation into the metric, feel free. I grew up south of the border. But this is a very large building. with a course of unused timber for each three courses of hewn stone. In other words, layer of wood, three layers of stone. Layer of wood, three layers of stone, which, by the way, parallels what Solomon did in the first temple. The expenses shall be paid by the palace. That's a good one. And the gold and silver vessels of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken away from the temple in Jerusalem and transported to Babylon, shall be returned, and let each go back to the temple in Jerusalem where it belongs. You shall deposit it in the house of God. Wow. What are the differences between what you saw in number 2 and what you saw in number 4?
This is very specific.
Yeah.
The other one is general.
Right. This one gives you details. Not to mention, it mentions that that he's going to fund the construction of the temple in Jerusalem. That's a detail I like. It's generally assumed that there actually was even more to the original text, and that what we're getting here in these two different places are pieces from the original decree. So part of the decree is recorded in the beginning, and part of the decree is later on in chapter 6. But either way, this marks great benevolence. Let's see what happens next. Take a look at source number 5, the Jewish response. So the chiefs of the clans of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and Levites, all whose spirit had been roused by God, got ready to go up to build the house of the Lord that is in Jerusalem. All their neighbors supported them with silver vessels, with gold, with goods, with livestock, and with precious objects, besides what had been given as a free will offering. So everybody actually supports them, right? Judah and Benjamin. It's fascinating to realize that they actually kept tribal identity, right? When they were removed from the land, they retained tribal identity. Why did they do that? What does that demonstrate to us? They plan on going back. They plan on returning. Right? They don't view themselves as Babylonians/Persians. They view themselves as exiled Israelites. Right? If you think of Joseph when he's in jail in Egypt, identifying himself consistently as an Ivri. Right? He says, I'm not an Egyptian. I'm not a Mitzri. Right? Yeah. Well, he is given an Egyptian name, let's be clear. Paro calls him that, and we never find him refer to himself that way. So if not Paneach, it says Paro called him that. It wasn't his decision. In Midrash, Moshe is condemned, because when Moshe flees from Egypt, and he goes to Midian, and he saves the daughters of Yitro at the well, they go back to their father, and they say to their father, Ish Mitzri Hitzilanu Miyad Haro'im, an Egyptian man saved us. And he doesn't correct them. Now, reading the text literally, he doesn't correct them because he's not there. He wasn't there at the time. But the Midrash is looking for some passage where he says to Yitro, I'm not an Egyptian, you should be aware of that. We don't find him. We don't find him telling him that. Yeah.
But Yitro knew he wasn't an Egyptian.
How?
Because he says to his daughters, "Call the man."
Right.
He doesn't refer to Moshe as a mystery because he knows no mystery would have done what Moshe did.
Well, he doesn't say call the man. He says kir en lo. It's just the pronoun. Call him. Kir en lo v'yochalechem. That's what he says.
I think so.
Don't laugh. Don't laugh. My list of mistakes is long and varied.
It's the pasuk refers to him as Ish. Well, why did you leave the man?
Right. That's true. Right. No, that's true.
So
same thing. Okay. So you think he's denying that Moshe is an Egyptian? Because an Egyptian wouldn't have. Could be. Okay, I'm actually going to come back to what motivated Moshe at the well later on, so we can talk about him further then. Okay, so Yehuda and Binyamin see themselves as Yehuda and Binyamin. They always expect to come back, and that's the way they identify themselves. They're not the only ones who return, but they're the bulk of those who return. Why are they the bulk of the ones who return? You know the story.
They're the actual location. Israel, because the 10 tribes had been...
Right. Correct. Jerusalem and Judea is dominated by Yehuda and Benjamin, Judah and Benjamin. There are also Levites around. There are also people from Shimon around, because they had cities that were within Judah. But the northern kingdom was exiled by the Assyrians. There is discussion of whether they came back before the end. The Talmud discusses that question. But they, meaning the end of the first temple. But fundamentally, what we're seeing here is that the group is indeed dominated by Judah and Benjamin. Take a look at source number 6 from the Midrash, which notes that the book of Ezra actually lists the Jews who came back by tribe. And it says, when enumerated, they are only 30,360, which is a problem because we are told that there are 42,000 who came back altogether. 42,360 or 42,630. Never remember which way the number works. But when enumerated, they are only 30,360. Where are the other 12,000? Rather, they ascended from the other tribes. That's the answer. There were other tribes represented, but the dominant group is indeed Yehuda and Benjamin, Judah, Benjamin, plus the tribe of Levi. So they're the ones who are going to come back. And who is it who gives for them to make this return? All their neighbors. Right? Everybody funds the return. And again, this takes us back to the idea that it's not just the Jewish neighbors who are coming back who fund it. All their neighbors decide to fund it. Let's move ahead with the story. We have to get to this basic story down before we can discuss what's really going on. Source number 7, please. King Cyrus of Persia released the vessels of the Lord's house, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken away from Jerusalem and had put in the house of his God. We already saw this referred to in the later version of the decree, in Ezra chapter 6. These King Cyrus of Persia released through the office of Mitridat, the treasurer, who gave an inventory of them to Sheshbatzar, the prince of Judah. Sheshbatzar is one of the leaders of the Jewish return. This may be the same person who was later called Zerubbabel, who is one of the political leaders of their return. This is the inventory. 30 gold basins, 1,000 silver basins, that's a lot of basins, 29 knives, 30 gold bowls, 410 silver double bowls, 1,000 other vessels, in all, 5,400 gold and silver vessels. Sheshbatzar brought all these back when the exiles came back from Babylon to Jerusalem, and that's the end of the chapter. Is this list of the vessels that return with them. So I gave you a link in source number 8 because I didn't want to distract from the longer discussion here, but I gave a class last year, I think, at some point, on these temple vessels that were being returned, because their saga is remarkable. It is emphasized every step of the way. Jeremiah predicts the temple vessels are going to be taken by the Babylonians. Actually, even before that, King Hezekiah puts them on display for the Babylonians in an earlier generation. Then they are taken by the Babylonians. They are then used by King Belshazzar, the Babylonian. Initially, they're put in the storehouse of the king in a place of respect. That's what Nebuchadnezzar does. But Belshazzar has them brought out and used at a feast of his. That's right before the Persians come in and destroy the Babylonian Empire. Then the Persians have the vessels, and the Persians send them back. And this ark mirrors the ark of the Jews in terms of their exile and return. There's even a midrash about Ahasuerus at his party bringing the vessels out for use at his party. So if you go to that link, you can hear the audio of my class about the vessels. It's a fascinating story. Yeah. Go ahead, Ethan.
Sheshbatzar, is he an Israelite or is he a
Persian? Okay, so Sheshbatzar is Jewish. He is believed to be from Yehuda. And he is listed in Ezra chapter 5 as being responsible for laying the foundations when they actually build the Beit HaMikdash, when they actually build the temple. He is the one who's in charge of that. Interestingly here, the term in the Hebrew is Nasi Yehuda. Later on, in chapter 5, he will be called the Pacha, which is a Persian-controlled governor. Often a local person, but under the government of Persia's control. Ibn Ezra believes that he actually is Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel, who we know of as the leader of the Jews in that early time, is Sheshbatzar, and he suggests that Zerubbabel is the Babylonian name for him, and Sheshbatzar is his Jewish name. Which is a possibility. Okay. One other note, just because I find it fascinating, there was a reference here to the vessels. In the original, those vessels are called agartal. Aleph Gimel Resh Tet Lamed. What is that in Hebrew today?
A vase.
A vase. So agartal makes it into modern Hebrew as a vase. I always assumed, when I knew the word agartal just from the Hebrew, I assumed it was a hybrid word. It's a contraction of agar, which is to store, and tal, which is dew, moisture. So it stores moisture. That's what I thought. However, the Dan Mikra edition of Ezra thinks that it's linked to an Aramaic word called kartalita, and that it's which sounds Spanish, but it's Aramaic. In any case, that's what they return. Parenthetically, what's missing from the list of vessels that are returned? Right, all the good stuff. The sheets are on the table over there, I believe. We're missing all the good stuff, right? We got basins, knives. What about the menorah? Right? What about the ark?
And what about jewelry?
You had on the clothing of the Kohen, you did have some, you had gold, you had gems, that's correct. So the question is, what happened to all of this? So the Talmud has a discussion about this. One view is that those things were buried before the first temple was destroyed. King Yoshiyahu knew what was coming. It had been predicted by the prophets, and if he buried it, the Babylonians never got a hold of it. That's one view. Another view is they simply didn't send it back. But either way, the Talmud is of the view that indeed we didn't have them. At the start of the Second Temple, they weren't there. And they're certainly missing from this list. But now we've seen the story, Ruth.
How did the menorah then get taken by the Romans to...
Right, so it's clear that we end up with a menorah in the Second Temple. It's clear that we have one. So whether we get the one back from the first or whether we create a new one, we have one. How do we know that there is a menorah in the Second Temple? Botella is the Mishkan. What? It is on the Archetypes, but... We have a holiday. It's called Hanukkah. Right? Hanukkah celebrates... Sorry? Right, but the arch is, you're right, the Arch of Titus does depict it, but the whole story of Hanukkah takes place in the Second Temple period. And the Greeks have contaminated the oil, and they need to get fresh oil. Where are you going to put the oil if you don't have a menorah? They're all standing there with the oil, right? The oil that burned miraculously was floating in the air. But no one mentions that in the miracle. No, yes, we did have a menorah, we just didn't necessarily get back the one from the First Temple. What do you mean? The menorah that we light?
Yeah.
Right. The one that we light is different. The one that we light is 8 branches. The one you have in the temple is 7 branches. Right. Because the one that we light marks the days of that miracle, the oil lasting for 8 days. It's not exactly what they had. Not only that, there actually is a halacha, there's a Jewish law, that one is not supposed to create a 7-branched menorah. Specifically, synagogues shouldn't have a 7-branched menorah. There's a whole discussion about this because you're not, there are various explanations, but on a very basic level, we try to model what we have on the temple, but we can't claim that we actually have the original. So we don't generally create 7-branched menorah. The Ner Tamid isn't from that. The Ner Tamid, the light that's always burning in the synagogue is because of the flame on the altar. It's not from the menorah. I know people always think that, and we call it Ner Tamid, which is... Yeah, we walk a fine line. Diane is correct. We walk a fine line between, on the one hand, emulating what went on in the temple, and on the other hand, not emulating it precisely. We want to mimic it, but we don't want to act as though, well, we have it back and everything is fine where we are. So, for example, the Pesach Seder. Right, Rabbi Gamliel says you have to mention 3 things at your Seder. What are they? Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. When you mention the Matzah, what do? You hold up a piece of the Matzah, the broken piece of Matzah generally, right? When you mention Maror, what do? You point to, you hold up a piece of the Maror. When you mention Pesach, what do? No, you don't point. Right, you don't identify it as the offering. And again, there are multiple reasons for that, but basically, we don't claim that we have the sacrifices, even as. says we memorialize them by having something on the Seder plate that's supposed to remember the sacrifice. We walk an interesting line on that. Yeah.
Musaf in every Shabbat is supposed to be in lieu of the sacrifice.
Right. Well, all of the prayers, you're right. Musaf, which we say today also for Rosh Chodesh. But in general, yes, all of our Amidot, each Amidah is supposed to be parallel to a service that goes on in the temple, in the Beit HaMikdash. Absolutely true. Either Judith or Ethi had a question or a comment. You were going to say something also before I went to Diane. No? Yeah, somebody said something. Okay.
Oh, yeah, the menorah in the Knesset.
Yes, they have a menorah in the Knesset.
They're not supposed to make a menorah, but there is one.
Right, so maybe because it's not in the synagogue, it's okay, or maybe they didn't ask. Take your pick.
Really?
It doesn't have seven?
One outside the Knesset.
Yeah, well, that's what we were just talking about, is the Knesset. Oh, the British gave it as a gift, so it's their fault. Yeah, okay. Maybe we should re-gift it. Okay. So my question to you is this. We have now read the story of Cyrus's permission for the Jews to return. The wording that he presented, well, let me not bias anything. What's his motivation? Why does Cyrus do this? Based on what you see in the text, what is motivating Cyrus to send the Jews back, to fund the temple, to return the vessels? What's his motivation? He believes that his success is a result of the Jews somehow. I mean, keep in mind, he hasn't released us yet, so it's a reward in advance, a down payment, for what he will do. Maybe, Diane? So there is discussion about Darius being the grandchild of Queen Esther. I don't think anyone puts Cyrus as
Cyrus is Darius's kid, though.
Well, then you get into the problem of there being too many Cyruses and Dariuses in the royal line, and that gets confusing. Yes.
Well, isn't it sort of the enemy of my enemy is my friend? So to keep peace in that area, he funds the Jews, and the other people that may have been his enemy are supposed to give the Jews all the gold and whatever to fund the temple.
So
to sort of peace in his empire,
yeah,
and expand his power.
So I would divide that into two different comments, right? The first being that this is a way to keep peace. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. The other being that it's being funded by the people who are his enemies. It seems like it's funded from rank and file Persians. It doesn't seem like it's being funded by enemies. That, I think, is a harder sell. But the idea that this is to pursue peace is one that we need to discuss. Other thoughts?
He doesn't personally contribute. That we don't know.
Well, he says he's funding the construction of the temple. That's not a small thing.
Maybe he's so grateful for what he has achieved that he's afraid something bad will happen if he doesn't appease the God of the Jews.
So he's grateful for what he has received, and therefore he does this because he fears something bad happening. It's very interesting. We talked about last time, I think, Ferdinand and Isabella. Right? So their decision to expel the Jews was an act of gratitude to their God for their defeat of the Muslims. The whole Reconquista, the conquest of Spain and uniting of Spain under them, they said, oh, and thanks to our God, we will kick out the Jews. So Cyrus, in gratitude for his conquest, also kicks out the Jews. But there's a common theme. But it's a very different experience. Yeah?
Jews' neighbors who were supposed to fund them,
yeah,
were not Persians. They were Babylonians.
Do we know that?
They were living in Babylon.
The Jews are living in Babylon, so therefore these are Babylonians.
Yeah.
So then we can come back to saying that he's actually using the enemies,
yeah,
in order to do this. So I would accept that, except for something we're going to see about his relationship with the Babylonians. When we come back to talk about Cyrus's relationship with the Babylonians, we might see another view. But I definitely hear you're right, they would be Babylonians. Yeah, they would be Babylonians. That's fair. So there's one view that says this story never happened. This story is fabricated. Historically, there were many who took that position. They said, this is the Jews writing their own history. And it sounds a lot better if you describe how Cyrus recognized the God of Israel, and Cyrus decided he's going to fund the building of the temple. In truth, as far as they were concerned, maybe we were just a ragtag group of people who coalesced one day and invented a history for ourselves through myths and legends, and we cobbled things together. Or maybe we were, in fact, Hebrews who had ended up in exile, and for whatever reason, eventually we were able to come back, and we drafted this as a record of our history. That lasted as a popular narrative until the year 1879. In the year 1879, that idea was blown to pieces. And we'll talk about why in a minute, or a few minutes. But since that year, it has come to be accepted that Cyrus permitted our return and even endorsed construction of our temple, even though, let it be said, that many among the scholars will still doubt aspects of this text. They'll say, well, even if he let you come back, it wasn't in this way. It wasn't with support by the non-Jewish neighbors for our return. It wasn't with payment for the construction of the temple. There's an interesting academic discussion of the points in this debate called the Edict of Cyrus in Ezra 1. I quoted it in source number 9 from a fellow by the name of Professor Elias Bickerman, who writes, if you do believe that this is fake, you have to explain how it is that the Jews ended up back there. Because, based on the archaeological evidence and the records of the historians, we now know what he writes here. Since there was a return from the captivity under Cyrus, there was a return, the king must have issued a proclamation summoning the exiles to go back to Jerusalem. But it is another question whether the text of the proclamation is trustworthy as given by the chronicler or has been more or less altered from its original form by the hagiographer. What's a hagiographer? Oh, I'm glad you asked.
Make someone into a saint.
Yeah, hagiography is when you rewrite the history in order to make things look better than they were and people look better than they were. That's the idea. So Bickerman is not somebody who's about to embrace the idea of prophets and prophecy and so on. I only bring him in order to show you somebody who says, look, you have to explain this somehow if you don't buy the story that's being told in Ezra, because we know the Jews are exiles in his land. We know that they are there as of the time of Cyrus, and we know that Cyrus allows them to come back. So you tell me what happened. If you don't like this story. But that's one view. Second view, opposite extreme. Cyrus has accepted the God of Israel. And there's reason for him to do so. Take a look at source number 10. I referred you to this before when we talked about the completion of the word of Jeremiah. Assuredly, thus said the Lord of hosts. Jeremiah is speaking in the last years of the first temple. Because you would not listen to my words, I'm going to send for all the peoples of the north, declares the Lord, and for my servant King Nebuchadrezzar of Babylon, sometimes his name is Nebuchadnezzar, sometimes it's Nebuchadrezzar, don't get hung up on it, and bring them against this land and its inhabitants and against all those nations round about. I will exterminate them and make them a desolation, an object of hissing, ruins for all time. I am bringing in nations from elsewhere, and they are going to they're going to destroy everything in the region. It's Babylon who is coming in. Babylon is technically north and east, but they attack from the north, and so they're always identified this way as coming from the north. And I will banish from them being the Jews and the nations of this region, the sound of mirth and gladness, the voice of bridegroom and bride, the sound of the mill, the light of the lamp. This whole land shall be a desolate ruin, and those nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. When the 70 years are over, I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation and the land of the Chaldeans for their sins, declares the Lord, and I will make it a desolation for all time. So Jeremiah already predicted 70 years of exile. And Isaiah, Yeshaya, who actually is speaking before Jeremiah, makes a prediction to top that one. Take a look at source number 11. This prediction is so startling that it leads some to doubt the authenticity of this passage in the book of Yeshaya, the book of Isaiah. Listen to this. Thus said the Lord, your Redeemer, who formed you in the womb. Isaiah is speaking somewhere in the middle of the first temple period. You would now be, just if you want to put a year on it, if you're working with a secular chronology, you are somewhere around the year 700 before the Common Era. Certainly the late 8th century before the Common Era. Thus said the Lord your Redeemer, who formed you in the womb. It is I, the Lord, who made everything, who alone stretched out the heavens and unaided spread out the earth, who annul the omens of diviners and make fools of the augurs, those who predict the future, who turn sages back and make nonsense of their knowledge, but confirm the word of my servant and fulfill the prediction of my messengers. It is I who say of Jerusalem, it shall be inhabited, and of the towns of Judah they shall be rebuilt, and I will restore their ruined places. I who said to the deep, be dry, I will dry up your floods, and the same who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, he shall fulfill all my purposes. He shall say of Jerusalem, she shall be rebuilt, and to the temple you shall be founded again. This is God making a prediction. He's calling his shot, right? For those who are familiar with the story of Babe Ruth, right, pointing over the left field fence, or right field, I think it was left field fence, and then hitting the home run there, right? That's what we're talking about. God says, I make fools of those who predict the future. This is part of a general section in Yeshaya, in Isaiah, in which God speaks of the idols of the nations and that the Jews have embraced, and says to them, they can't predict the future. I can tell you what's going to be long before it ever happens. And he says,
and there's no King Cyrus yet at this time.
There are no Persians yet. I mean, there are Persians, but the Jews don't know them. This is before the Babylonians have come in and destroyed the temple. He is predicting that the Persians are going to come along, conquer the Babylonians, and they will have a king whose name is going to be Cyrus. And this is what he's going to do. Thus said the Lord to Cyrus, his anointed one. You know what the word for that is in Hebrew? His Mashiach, Mishicho, Koresh Mishicho, whose right hand he has grasped, treading down nations before him, ungirding the loins of kings, opening doors before him and letting no gate stay shut. I will march before you and level the hills that loom up. I will shatter doors of bronze and cut down iron bars. I will give you treasures concealed in the dark and secret hoards, so that you may know that it is I, the Lord, the God of Israel, who call you by name. I apologize for using the JPS translation instead of doing my own, but there was so much text. So you just have to deal with the funny capital letters. But the idea here is that in fact this is predicted before it ever happens. Cyrus is God's Mashiach. Originally it was supposed to be King Hezekiah. Hezekiah disappoints God. He does not fulfill his mission. And now Cyrus is going to be the Mashiach. He is going to be God's anointed one who will let us come back. Now, as I said, skeptics who don't like the idea of, you know, future telling, and the idea that someone could have actually reported this centuries before it occurs, will say that this is written later on. Either it is written when the Jews are in exile under the Babylonians and as the Persians are a rising empire, or it's written even later than that when the Jews are actually back in their land. I have reason to think that, well, number one, I accept the idea of prophecies. That's number one. But number two, I have reason to doubt their skepticism. If you go to the class that I linked in source number 12, it's an introduction to Isaiah. Those who have the Tanakh in a Day program, that was the class I gave there. You can hear more of a discussion about the book of Isaiah and the idea of whether it's one book or two books or even three books. So you can hear that there. But the point is that within this view, Cyrus knows that he has been named the anointed one of God, and that's what he is fulfilling.
But he also knows that God will punish the king of Babel. And isn't he now the king of Babel because he captured it from Nebuchadnezzar?
Right, he's punishing the Babylonians.
But no, it says, I will punish the king of Babylon.
Yeah, when the 70 years are over.
Isn't he the king of the 70 years? So isn't he, shouldn't he hedge his bets because he's the king of the 70? He's the king at the reign of the end of the 70 years.
Yeah.
Cyrus. Yes. God said, at the end of the 70 years, that king's going to get it.
Yeah,
and
no, but that's when Cyrus. But look what year Cyrus does this in. When did Cyrus do this? The first year of his reign. In other words, he is at the end of the 70 years. He destroys Babylon and lets the Jews come back. He is the fulfillment of this.
He's the fulfillment of Yirmiyahu, and then he's the beginning of it.
Correct. And that makes a lot of sense in explaining why he does this right away. Right? This is my first 100 days in office. Right? I'm going to send the Jews back to their land. That's the idea. It's really remarkable. By the way, there are all sorts of really interesting parallels between this and the Exodus, the Jews getting out of Egypt. That's a theme that Yeshaya, that Isaiah already develops. Take a look at source number 13, please. He predicts that when we return to our land, the Lord will dry up the tongue of the Egyptian sea. He will raise his hand over the Euphrates with the might of his wind and break it into seven wadis so that it can be trodden dry shod. Thus there shall be a highway for the other part of his people out of Assyria, such as there was for Israel when it left the land of Egypt. This is before the whole thing with the Babylonians. This is before Hezekiah has lost the confidence of God. At the time, the Assyrians are the major enemy. And the prediction is, though, that it will be as it was when we left Egypt, which will explain what's going on in terms of having the neighbors fund our return. Go back to the book of Exodus, source number 14. And the children of Israel, this is when we leave Egypt, and the children of Israel did as Moshe had said, and they asked of Egypt silver and gold vessels and clothing. I put the word asked in quotes. Literally, the word in Hebrew is Vayishalu, which can mean they asked, it can mean they borrowed. Either way, they weren't giving it back. And God put the nation's favor in the eyes of Egypt, and they lent to them. And they emptied Egypt. Of course, our view is that this was, you know, wages for centuries of slavery. But the point is that you're seeing a repeat of a foreign king recognizing God, sending us out to the land of Israel, and the nation even funding our trip. So what you're seeing here in this view of the story is that Cyrus believes there's a prophecy, and he is the fulfillment of that prophecy. And so he says, God gave me this land, may God be with them as they go, the whole bit. That's your second explanation. Yes? How would Cyrus know of the prophecy? Good question. To which the answer would be what? The answer is, we have had many prophets who traveled among the nations and conveyed messages to them, Jonah being the most famous, right? And so the idea would be, Isaiah is long gone by this time, but his book records that he had students who wrote down his prophecies and didn't necessarily even publicize them at the time. The Jews who know Isaiah don't necessarily hear this message with all the specifications about Cyrus. But his students say to Cyrus, you know, we have a prediction that you were going to rise. We've been holding on to this. And that's possible as an explanation. I have other ideas, but that's another possibility. Morris.
Are there any historical non-Jew sources that the Persians resettled other nations in their lands?
That is exactly where we're going next. That was a perfect segue. Thank you. That was ideal. There's a third view. And the third view is that Cyrus is simply a smart politician. He's a smart politician. And that brings me back to the year 1879. And the discovery of what you see here, after source number 14, the Cyrus cylinder in a picture courtesy of Wikimedia Commons. If you've seen an actual picture, you know this is made out of clay, or if you've actually seen it in a museum. It's made out of clay. It's a cuneiform tablet, so everything is, you know, chiseled into the clay. It is less than 1 foot long. And what it records is the declaration of Cyrus that he is going to restore Babylon, not Jews, he restored Babylon, and he's going to support the temples of Marduk, one of the Babylonian gods, Because Marduk had rejected the Babylonian king, and Marduk has chosen Cyrus as his, so to speak, anointed one. In other words, Cyrus has a strategy, and it's a smart strategy. We know before Cyrus two methods of conquest in this region. The first method of conquest is defeat people, demand taxes from them, and post garrisons of your soldiers to keep them in line. Right? That's a standard way to do things. The Assyrians were smarter. The Assyrians said, let's do population transfer. Because otherwise, we're going to have to sit there dealing with revolt after revolt. But if we swap populations, then it's harder for them to revolt, and they don't have anything to fight for. So when they conquer the 10 northern tribes, they move them out. And they take other tribes they've conquered, and they move them in. That's how you get the Samaritans. So they, so that's the Assyrian method. But Cyrus says, what do I need with headaches like this? Let me just pose as their friend. I'll be nice to them. Realpolitik. And this goes back to preserving peace. All I have to do is present myself as believing in their God and help them by rebuilding their temples and tell them, you can do what you want. Worship your gods. I don't care. It's no skin off of my nose. As long as you pay tribute to my government and he had taxes that he demanded, everything else is fine. That was the method that the Persians employed. And not only with us, but we have a record of them doing it with the Babylonians. It just makes so much sense as a policy that you sort of wonder why it took people so long to get there. They take a look at source number 15. Professor Lucas Schulte, Good Public Relations, What Persian Propaganda Tells Us About the Nehemiah Memoir. We're not going into the Nehemiah piece of this, but just what he talks about with Cyrus. Inscriptions ranging from the first Persian king Cyrus through Artaxerxes in the book of Nehemiah reveal elements in common in both Babylonian and Egyptian texts. The Cyrus cylinder describes a Babylonian god Marduk choosing Cyrus to rule kindly over the Babylonians as, quote, king of Babylon. This inscription demonstrates important Persian propaganda innovation. They use the language, in this case Babylonian cuneiform, inscription style, foundational cylinders that have been used for centuries, local gods, Marduk and Nabu, and the local royal title, King of Babylon, of their subject peoples. So in other words, the Cyrus cylinder looks like a Babylonian document. No previous kings in the ancient Near East had used this combination of methods. Chapters 40 to 55 of the book of Isaiah depict a similar image of Cyrus in a Judean religious context. God gives Cyrus authority over Judah and the nations, and Cyrus is even given the royal title of Messiah. And so that's your third possibility. Cyrus is posing, right? He says, I don't want trouble with these people I've inherited. I'm going to do this the easy way. They'll be my friends. I'll fund their temple. You know, it's a down payment. It's not even a down payment. It's a loss leader. In order to be able to get them back. So those are your three possibilities. I actually would argue that what's going on here has a little bit more intrigue, and the answer is that view number two and view number three are both correct. They're both right. We have many places in Tanakh where God speaks of controlling and manipulating kings. I'm going to actually just speak straight at this point because there's not that much time left and I want to get through this. But directly, Pharaoh, right? King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon as well, after his conquest of the Jews, in the first four chapters of the book of Daniel, we find God dealing with kings directly and indirectly. Source number 16 from Jeremiah, as well as a source we already saw from Jeremiah, speaks of God giving all of these lands to his servant, King Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, as far as God is concerned, is his pawn. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't know that. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't think of himself as fulfilling God's will. It's indirect. And I think that that's the idea here. Take a look at source number 17. The verse from Isaiah that immediately follows the naming of Cyrus that you saw in number 11. It's the very next verse. Isaiah says, "For the sake of my servant Jacob, Israel my chosen one, I call you, Cyrus, by name. I hail you by title, though you have not known me." Anyone here in the synagogue ever say the song Anim Zmiros, or Anim Zmirot? There's a line in it in which we say of God, Achancha velo yedat, Achancha velo yedaticha. I name you, but I don't really know you. That comes from here. The same wording is used here. God says, Achancha, I named you, I called you by name, but you don't know me. He said, in other words, what God is saying is, Cyrus doesn't hear the prophecy from somebody. Cyrus doesn't have a student of Isaiah feeding him information. Cyrus doesn't know anything from God. Cyrus believes that he is carrying out a strategy to control a population he has received as part of conquering Babylon. However, Tanakh is suggesting that God is pulling the strings. And this goes back to what we saw in source number 2. When it said, when the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah was fulfilled, the Lord roused the spirit of King Cyrus of Persia. The text in the original Hebrew is, Heir Hashem et Rucho. God roused his spirit. That's a good translation. But that phrase is used not to indicate that God speaks to him, but rather to indicate that God inspires him. And I brought you sources in 18 and 19, but I'm going to say it outside. This is the idea that we call in Hebrew, Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration. As explained by Maimonides, this is the lowest level of prophecy. And what it is when a person has a desire to do something anyway, it's their nature to do something, and God strengthens it and enables them to do something that otherwise they would have stopped short of doing. So the classic example, and this is what I had mentioned to Moish, is Moshe at the well. When Moshe saves the daughters of Yitro, who are at the well, from the shepherds who are harassing them, that's very consistent with his personality. We already know he left the palace and he saw an Egyptian beating a Jew and he got involved. However, it would be a mistake for Moshe to get involved now at the well. He's a fugitive. Right? He just killed somebody in Egypt, and he found out that everybody knows, and he ran away. Right? So the first thing he's going to do is get into a brawl at the local pub. Like, doesn't just announce to the world, hey, the Egyptian prince is here. It's not smart. It says Maimonides, that's Heir Hashem et Rucho. This is God awakening his spirit, not consciously, but turbocharging that which was already in him, so that he will do something that otherwise he would not have done. And that's why Rabbi Shimshon Rafael Hirsch explains in source number 19 what happens here. It's not that Cyrus knows God has picked me. As far as he's concerned, he's just being smart. However, Tanakh is trying to tell us that's what's going on behind the scenes. And this, to me, is the major lesson to learn in this story. To look beyond the superficial of what goes on in our world and to ask ourselves, with all the politicians and all the kings who think that they are brilliant leaders and that they're working on plots and so on, is the hand of God actually moving the pieces? And Tanakh is arguing, you bet. That's the idea. I'll take one comment from Judith, because I have another minute, and then unfortunately I have to race out, but I have to be somewhere. Yes?
Does it include the free will part?
Oh boy, that's the question you have to ask with 1 minute left. What happened to free will? So Maimonides asked that question and couldn't answer it. He also discussed the possibility that maybe a conqueror who is condemned in the Torah and in Tanakh for doing harsh things could say, well, you know what? God made me do it. So his argument, Maimonides' argument regarding the person who wants to exonerate himself is to say, you chose to do this. You didn't know what the plan was, and also they may have been more cruel than they had to be in order to fulfill God's plan, and maybe that's why they get punished for it. But the question of free will, and is it free if you don't know what you're being forced to do, is a really good question that really requires its own session. Thank you very much.